Chapter 47. By presidential directive, the U.S. Coast Guard cutter Polar Dawn steamed stridently across the maritime boundary with Canada, just north of the Yukon. As it moved east across the corrugated gray waters of the Beaufort Sea, Captain Edwin Murdoch stared out the bridge window in silent relief. There was no armed Canadian flotilla there to challenge him, as a few aboard the ship had feared. Their mission had begun innocuously enough several months earlier with a proposal to seismically map the periphery sea ice along the Northwest Passage. However, this was well before the Atlanta and Ice Research Lab 7 incidents. The president, concerned about fanning the flames of Canadian indignation, had initially canceled the voyage, but the Secretary of Defense had finally convinced him to proceed with the mission, successfully arguing that the Canadians had previously given implicit approval. It might be years, he asserted, before the U.S. could challenge Canada's internal waters claim without overt provocation. "Skies clear, radar screen empty, and seas at 324, said the Polar Dawn's executive officer, a rail-thin African-American named Wilkes. "Perfect conditions in which to run the passage." "Let's hope they continue for the next 6 days," Murdoch replied. He noticed a glint in the sky out the starboard bridge window. "Our upstairs escort is still holding the trail?" he asked. "I believe they are going to keep an eye on us for the first 50 miles into Canadian waters," Wilkes replied, referring to a Navy P-3 Orion reconnaissance plane that lazily circled overhead. "After that, we're on our own." Nobody really expected the Canadians to oppose them, but the ship's officers and crew were well aware of the heated rhetoric that had been erupting from Ottawa the past 2 weeks. Most recognized it for what it was, empty posturing by some politicians attempting to capture a few votes. Or so they hoped. The Polar Dawn moved east through the Beaufort Sea, skirting along the jagged edge of the sea ice that occasionally crumbled into a mass of irregular-shaped floes. The Coast Guard vessel towed a sledge-shaped seismic sensor off the stern, which mapped the depth and density of the ice sheet as they steamed by. The waters held clear of traffic, save for the occasional fishing boat or oil exploration vessel. Sailing through the first brief Arctic night without incident, Murdoch slowly began to relax. The crew settled into their varied work schedules, which would serve them for the nearly 3-week voyage to New York Harbor. The sea ice had encroached closer to the mainland as they sailed east, gradually constricting the open waterway to less than 30 miles as they approached the Amundsen Gulf, south of Banks Island. Passing the 500-mile mark from Alaska, Murdoch was surprised that they still hadn't encountered any Canadian picket vessels. He had been briefed that 2 Canadian Coast Guard vessels regularly patrolled the Amundsen Gulf, picking up any eastbound freighters that hadn't paid their passage fees. "Victoria Island coming into view," Wilkes announced. All eyes on the bridge strained to make out the tundra-covered island through a damp gray haze. Larger than the state of Kansas, the huge island pressed a 400-mile-long coastline opposite the North American mainland. The waterway ahead of the Polar Dawn constricted again as they entered the Dolphin and Union Strait, named for 2 small boats used by Franklin on an earlier Arctic expedition. The ice shelf crept off both shorelines, narrowing the open seaway through the strait to less than 10 miles. The Polar Dawn could easily shove through the adjacent meter-thick ice if necessary, but the ship kept to the ice-free path melted by the warm spring weather. The Polar Dawn forged another 100 miles through the narrowing strait as its second Arctic night in Canadian waters approached. Murdoch had just returned to the bridge after a late dinner when the radar operator announced first one and then another surface contact. "They're both stationary at the moment," the operator said. "One's to the north, the other almost directly south. We'll run right between them on our current heading." "Our picket has finally appeared," Murdoch said quietly. As they approached the 2 vessels, a larger ship appeared on the radar some 10 miles ahead. The sentry vessels remained silent as the Polar Dawn cruised past, one on either flank. As the Coast Guard ship moved on unchallenged, Murdoch stepped over to the radar station and peered over the operator's shoulder. With a measure of chagrin, he watched as the 2 vessels slowly departed their stations and gradually fell in line behind his own ship. It appears we may have trouble passing go in collecting our $200, he said to Wilkes. The radio is still silent, the exec observed. Maybe they're just bored. A hazy dusk had settled over the strait, painting the distant shoreline of Victoria Island a deep purple. Murdoch tried to observe the ship ahead through a pair of binoculars, but could only make out a dark gray mass from the bow profile. The captain adjusted course slightly so as to pass the ship on his port side with plenty of leeway, but he would never get the chance. In the fading daylight, they closed within 2 miles of the larger ship when a sudden spray of orange light burst from its gray shadow. The Polar Dawn's bridge crew heard a faint whistling, then saw an explosion in the water a quarter mile off their starboard bow. The startled crew watched as the spray of water from the blast rose 40 feet into the air. They fired a shell at us, Wilkes blurted in a shocked voice. A second later, the long, silent radio finally crackled. Polar Dawn, Polar Dawn, this is the Canadian warship Manitoba. You are trespassing in a sovereign waterway. Please heave to and prepare for boarding. Murdoch reached for a radio transmitter. Manitoba, this is the captain of the Polar Dawn. Our transit route has been filed with the Foreign Affairs Ministry in Ottawa. Request you let us proceed. Murdoch gritted his teeth as he waited for a response. He had been given strict orders not to provoke a confrontation at any cost. But he had also been given assurances that the Polar Dawn's passage would be uncontested. Now he was getting shot at by the Manitoba, a brand new Canadian cruiser built expressly for Arctic duty. Though technically a military vessel, the Polar Dawn had no armament with which to fight. And it wasn't a particularly fast ship. Certainly it was incapable of outrunning a modern cruiser. With the two smaller Canadian vessels blocking the rear, there was no place to run anyway. There was no immediate answer to Murdoch's radio call, only a silent pause, and then another orange flash from the deck of the Manitoba. This time the shell from the warship's 5-inch gun landed a scant 50 yards from the Coast Guard ship, its underwater blast sending a concussion that could be felt throughout the vessel. On the bridge, the radio crackled once more. Polar Dawn, this is Manitoba, spoke a voice with a kindly charm that was incongruous to the situation at hand. I must insist that you heave to for boarding. I'm afraid I have orders to sink you if you don't comply. Over. Murdoch didn't wait for another orange flash from the Manitoba. All stop, he ordered the helmsman. In a heavy voice, he radioed the Manitoba his concession. He quickly had the radio man send a coded message to the Coast Guard sector headquarters in Juneau, explaining their predicament. Then he quietly waited for the Canadian borders, wondering if his career was all but over. A heavily armed team of Canadian special forces pulled alongside the Polar Dawn within minutes and quickly boarded the ship. Executive Officer Wilkes met the boarders and escorted them to the bridge. The leader of the special forces team, a short man with a lantern jaw, saluted Murdoch. Lieutenant Carpenter, Joint Task Force 2 Special Forces, he said. I have orders to take command of your vessel and bring her to port at Kugluktuk. And what of the crew? Murdoch asked. That's for the higher-ups to decide. Murdoch stepped nearer, looking down on the shorter lieutenant. An army soldier who knows how to pilot a 300-foot ship? He asked skeptically. Ex-merchant marine. Carpenter smiled. Helped push coal barges up the St. Lawrence in my daddy's tug since I was 12. Murdoch could do nothing but grimace. The helm is yours, he said finally, standing aside. True to his claim, Carpenter expertly guided the Polar Dawn through the strait and across the western reaches of Coronation Gulf, nosing into the small port of Kugluktuk 8 hours later. A small contingent of Royal Canadian Mounted Police lined the dock as the ship tied up at a large industrial wharf. The Manitoba, which had shadowed the Polar Dawn all the way to port, tooted its horn from out in the bay, then turned and headed back into the gulf. The Polar Dawn's crew was rounded up and marched off the cutter to a white dockside building that had formerly been a fish house, its weathered exterior peeling and blistered. Inside, several rows of makeshift bunks had been hastily set up to accommodate the imprisoned crew. The men were confined in relative comfort, however, their captors providing warm food, cold beer, and books and videos for entertainment. Murdoch approached the Mountie in charge, a towering man with ice-blue eyes. "How long are we to be confined here?" the captain asked.
"I don't really know myself. All I can tell you is that our government is demanding an apology and reparations for the destruction of the Beaufort Sea ice camp and an acknowledgement that the Northwest Passage is rightly part of Canada's internal waters. It's up to your government leaders to respond. Your men will be treated with all consideration, but I must warn you not to attempt an escape. We have been authorized to use force as necessary."
Murdoch nodded, suppressing a smile. The request, he knew, would go over in Washington like a lead balloon.